Travel Ban 2.0 on hold today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The courts put the brakes on President Trump's latest travel ban, and in response, Trump once again lashes out at the judges.
Every time Trump loses, he attacks the judiciary, calling them names, questioning their motives. I think that comes back to haunt him and hurt him moving forward.
Plus, the dangers of performing surgery in a Syrian war zone.
One day, the general surgeon was performing an operation, and there was a big attack near to the hospital, and they had to go, leaving the patient alone in that room.
And the Jordanian woman who decided early on that she wanted to be a boxer.
So I have to confess something. I'm a troublemaker.
Now she's an inspiration to Jordanian girls. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Thanks for being with us today. And here we go again with the travel ban and the courts pushing back on it. President Trump's travel ban 2.0 was supposed to go into effect today, but two federal judges, one in Hawaii, the other in Maryland, put it on hold. Yes, we have been here before. Trump's new executive order temporarily bans travel to the U.S. for citizens from six countries, as opposed to the original seven. Iraq is not on the list anymore, but Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen are. There are also other differences, but President Trump himself doesn't seem to think that the two versions of his travel ban are all that different. Here he is speaking in Tennessee last night.
The lawyers all said, oh, let's tailor it. This is a watered-down version of the first one. This is a watered-down version. And let me tell you something. I think we ought to go back to the first one and go all the way, which is what I wanted to do in the first one.
Trump's first travel ban was halted because the courts found, in part, that the measure discriminated on the basis of people's religion, Muslims specifically. And it's a similar story with a new one, according to Mana Yagani. She's an immigration lawyer based in Houston.
Religious discrimination pretty much sums up both judges' rulings.
Right. And these are words that Trump spoke on the campaign trail about targeting Muslims. So if this is the case, religious discrimination in this travel ban, it's embedded in it. Is there any version of the ban that'll cut legal muster?
That's the million-dollar question, whether the Trump administration can proceed with this and to avoid the religious discrimination issue that these judges are seeing. So the president has a double task ahead of him right now with respect to these two decisions from the federal judges.
Right, but it's applied to the entire country, correct?
Correct. The ruling is a temporary restraining order nationwide. If the Trump lawyers wanted to appeal this, if they wanted to appeal the Maryland decision, it would go to the Fourth Circuit. And if they wanted to appeal the federal judge's decision in Hawaii, it would go to the Ninth Circuit.
So remind us again, what was different about the revised travel ban and the earlier one from January that Trump had to retreat from?
The revised travel ban had excluded green card holders, and it had also said that if someone currently has a valid visa, they would be able to travel to the United States. Also, it eliminated Iraq from the list of banned countries, taking, you know, seven countries and reducing it to six countries. However, the predicament here is that in the first order, the president had said that the existing screening procedures are very defective for these countries listed. And as a result of that, we have to put a blanket ban to stop these people from coming in. But then in the new order, the president said somehow the current screening is good enough to assure anyone who already has a visa can safely be exempted from the national ban. So, you know, there's contradicting statements as to the motive and the goal of this order. If it's for national security, then how are they making this exemptions for those who already have visas if they're saying the screening is defective?
Mm.
What was interesting is one of the law professors this morning said that the political surrogates for Trump are throwing red meat in the media, and then the Justice Department lawyers are talking like vegans in court. There's a contradicting vibe that's coming out of the White House.
So do the actions of these two federal judges in Hawaii and Maryland effectively halt the implementation of this travel ban now? And like if you're from Yemen, for example, and you have a visa, can you now, because of the actions of these two judges, can you now travel to the U.S. and pass customs?
That's correct. If you are from any of those listed countries, the travel ban does not apply to you, and you may travel to the United States with a valid visa. However, the problem that the travelers will have is we don't know what will be the next action and how long these travelers have to make their way to the United States. If an emergency stay is filed, how soon will that be ruled on and how will that affect those who are en route with their visas trying to make it to the United States?
Mana, you're an immigration lawyer. I know you've got clients who are currently or might be affected by the revised ban. Describe how they're feeling with this legal roller coaster, a new ban, then judges say no, it doesn't hold up. And what are they feeling? What are they going through?
It's a very tumultuous experience for them. It's a very uncertain feeling. Yesterday, I met with an Iranian couple. The husband is a student at Texas A&M studying engineering, and his wife is here with him. However, her visa is about to expire in July. And they came to see me for a consultation because she did not know what to do. If she were to leave the country to go back to Iran or go to one of the U.S. embassies to renew her visa, she may be subject to the travel ban and not be able to come back to be reunited with her husband. If she doesn't leave the country, she's violating the terms of her visa. So they were very desperate, almost in tears, saying that, you know, they want to follow the law and they want advice about what to do because they don't want to be separated from each other. And her husband has two more years on his PhD studies in Texas. So people are just left in uncertainty because of this uncertainty that it creates for those individuals.
Mana Yaghani is an immigration lawyer in Houston. Thanks for being with us, Mana.
Thank you. My pleasure.
As you just heard, one of the main arguments against President Trump's travel ban is that it only targets Muslim-majority nations. And there were Trump's own words during the campaign when he said he wanted to ban Muslims from coming to the U.S. Many Muslim Americans worry that the ban is part of a larger trend of rising hate crimes and anti-Muslim sentiment in America. Khalid Latif hears about those worries and feels them himself. He's an imam and also a chaplain for the New York City Police Department, and we're going to hear his story now. It's part of a digital series by filmmaker Joshua Seftel called The Secret Life of Muslims. Here's Latif.
I was 24 years old when I started working at the police department as a Muslim chaplain, and the uniform in and of itself just commands a lot of respect. Everyone's calling you sir. You have men who are twice your age who stop everything to salute you. There was times I walked in the bathroom and guys are standing at urinals. They would turn around and salute me. I'm like, guys, don't do that. But that's because I'm in a uniform, right? I still have the realities of not in a uniform, where I get pulled over. I've been asked, you know, do I actually own my car? Did I steal my car? When I engage in conversation, I show my badge. The tenor changes quite drastically. When I land on international flights, you know, the announcement would go off, TSA is doing random checks, have your passports ready. Essentially, I was a random check. They'd then take me, escorted to a detaining room. I've seen women who are as old as my grandmother in detaining rooms being railed into by people because they can't speak English so well, while their 13-year-old grandsons are sitting and watching. When they would go through my belongings and they'd find my police credentials, they'd start asking me, you know, why are we stopping you? And I'd say to them, why do you think you're stopping me? They'd say, look, man, you're young and you're male and you're Muslim, and those things don't go so well together right now. I've sat down with people like Pope Francis, the Dalai Lama. I've met with President Obama on multiple occasions. And these are the kind of things that happen to people like me with those connections. You got to really think what's happening to people who don't have those connections and what their lives are like day to day. The deeply entrenched racisms that exist in our country have to be addressed. And they have to be addressed not for the sake of any singular minority population, but really for the sake of all of us just as human beings.
Khalid Latif is a Muslim chaplain for the NYPD. His story is part of the Secret Life of Muslims series. You can see the latest video in the series over at PRI.org. This week, Pope Francis marked his fourth year as head of the Catholic Church. The former Jesuit priest from Argentina has made his mark on world affairs, that much is clear. Francis is widely recognized as a moral leader. The pontiff has also raised hopes about change at the Vatican without necessarily delivering on those hopes. And on one issue in particular, Francis still faces a steep uphill struggle. From the World's Religion Desk, Matthew Bell has that story. In the first year of his tenure, Pope Francis announced that he would create a Vatican commission for the protection of minors. For some, this was a sign that the new pope was serious about addressing the issue of child sex abuse by Catholic clergy. But when Francis asked Marie Collins to be part of the commission, she says she had reason to be skeptical.
Because a lot of people felt that I was just being asked to join the commission as a sort of token survivor.
Collins was sexually abused by a priest in Ireland when she was a child. Years later, she pressed charges in court and won. Collins went on to become an advocate for other victims. When she got that offer to join the Pope's commission, she says she saw it as a way to make sure the Vatican was sincere about protecting children.
So I decided to join and see how it turned out.
Collins says everyone on the commission worked very hard. They came up with some concrete recommendations, like setting up tribunals to hold clergy accountable. But there were bureaucratic hurdles at every turn. Collins says she stuck with it for 3 years. In the end, she says she had no choice but to resign.
Although the Pope has backed initiatives put forward by the commission, they haven't actually turned into reality. So what we have now still is words and no actions.
Early on, Collins says the Papal Commission was denied funding and denied access to Vatican officials. The last straw, she says, was the refusal by Vatican departments to provide a basic response to the victims and survivors who had sent in correspondence about their cases. Collins says the default position in the Catholic Church on the issue of child sex abuse is denial and obfuscation. And she resigned from the commission to let that be known publicly.
How much more do they need to know? They used to go along with this story of, you know, it was a learning curve and they didn't understand. You know, we're years down the line now. You know, they can't be that stupid that they still don't understand. They shouldn't be able to get away with that anymore.
The head of the Vatican Commission for Protecting Minors is Cardinal Sean O'Malley, who's also Archbishop of Boston. After Marie Collins resigned, O'Malley told the Boston Globe that he shared some of her frustrations. He called Collins an extraordinary contributor to the commission and said the church needs to listen to the voices of victims. But O'Malley defended Pope Francis's record on this issue, saying that he's bringing change to the Vatican bureaucracy, which is always difficult. The Pope himself has sent mixed signals, says Paul Vallely. He's the author of a biography about Pope Francis called The Struggle for the Soul of Catholicism. Vallely points out that Francis has met with victims and called for zero tolerance for both abusers and those who cover up for them.
There's no doubt that on a personal level, he has an awful lot of sympathy for this. But on the institutional level, he seems more blind to it.
Vallely says Pope Francis has accomplished something remarkable. In the last 4 years, he's got people all over the world rethinking their views of the Catholic Church.
Because he's made being a Catholic something positive in the modern world. And yet, this issue is there under the skin, and it hasn't gone away, and he really needs to get to grips with it.
One thing Francis could do is follow the advice of his own commission and set up tribunals to hold Catholic clergy accountable for the protection of children. But so far, no one, no priests and no bishops, have faced prosecution under any new rules. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Last summer, the war in Syria became focused on one place, the city of Aleppo. Rebel-held areas of the city were being pounded mercilessly by the Syrian army. We spoke with several people there about the siege, but one voice in particular really cut through. Dr. Farida, the last remaining female OBGYN in the city. She told us at the time what it was like to live and work under near constant bombardment.
Always, there's an airstrikes always. Every day, every morning and every night there's an airstrikes. Last night we have a woman who was bleeding during delivery. And we stayed 4 hours beside her, and she's good now.
Even as she spoke, you could hear explosions in the background. By the way, Dr. Farida uses only one name for security reasons. She and her ophthalmologist husband, Dr. Abdulhalek, kept treating their patients as long as they could. But after government forces defeated the rebels in Aleppo, there were large-scale evacuations. The two doctors also left. Yesterday, the couple was in Washington testifying before Congress about the war in Syria.
Dr. Farida recounted for lawmakers how she was performing a C-section when a missile struck her hospital in Aleppo.
There was amounts of dust and small stones all around the room. And we look at ourselves and I look at my colleagues and find all them filled, covered with dust. The patient's abdomen was full of debris and we had to clean it with saline. But this was not the first time and not the last time, because many times we had many accidents like this. One day the general surgeon was performing an operation and there was a big attack near to the hospital and the wall dropped down and they had to go, leaving the patient alone in that room. And when it was better and the airplane gone away, then they go back to the room and they take the patient out of the hospital and they complete the operation in another hospital. It's very bad. And my daughter was with me and she witnessed all that accidents.
Dr. Abdulhalik, what memories does that description we just heard, what does it evoke for you?
There is a lot of bad memories, hard memories, heart accidents. I remember a lot of patients had lost their eyes. Many of them, due to shrapnel, entered the cornea and go deep to the retina. So I have to make an operation for them, and they lost their eyes. Another accident when chlorine gas. They attacked us with chlorine gas on 10th and 11th of December. And there were children in the hospital. And we have only one bottle of oxygen. That bottle, we had to transfer the mask between these children to give everyone a little amount of oxygen. It was a horrible day that day.
Dr. Abdulhalik, you and Dr. Farida arrived in Washington at a moment when Congress is considering slashing budgets for diplomacy and foreign aid. Possibly there could be deep cuts in humanitarian aid. What was your message for the lawmakers in the middle of this atmosphere?
All the NGO humanitarian action must continue. We are evacuated from Aleppo and we are in the north of Syria. Now there is more than 500,000 of IDPs. There in the camps.
Internally displaced people, yeah.
Yes. They need medical service. They need education. NGOs alone can't do all this job.
Could I ask you a personal question? Because I know you were both in the siege of Aleppo with your daughter. She's 8 years old. What was that like as a parent?
We are afraid for her future. She are afraid every day. She see nightmares. When we send her to the school, always we are in a deep sorrow because the school are also targeted. And one day, Dr. Farida has told that is the hospital, the school was targeted. So she run out of the hospital and go to the school. And
that day, my daughter was at the school and I heard the sound of bombardment and the school was close to my hospital. And I asked everyone, where is that attack? And they told me it's on the school. So I ran there with my operation dress and I go running like a crazy man, go there and then I look at the school and I find no one was there. I ask them, what's happening? What happened? They told me that someone told them that the school will be attacked. And then they evacuate the school before the attack with 1 hour. And so my daughter was at home at that moment. When he attacked the school. But it, if she was there, it will be a big massacre.
Right.
Another time, when chlorine attacked M2 hospital, and it was next to the hospital. So our daughter was affected with that chlorine, and she ran to her mother and hugged her, and she said, Mommy, I can't breathe. So Dr. Farida gave her a mask of oxygen to be good.
It must be really hard to think about the future as a family when you're just trying to survive every day. Did you ever think about sending your daughter away from Aleppo to stay with another family in another country? Was that even possible?
No, it's not possible because we will worry about her. We had to contact her every day. Now we left her in Istanbul, but we are contacting her by Skype every day.
And now you're in Idlib. What are your plans now? What's next?
We are going to establish a new life. I am searching for a job there, and Dr. Farida found a job there, and we will continue doing our duty in the north of Syria.
After all of what you've been through, is it hard to stay together as a family?
No. The siege make us love each other more than the time before the siege. Because always when there is a bomb or there is an attack close to us, we all hug each other. So that make us love each other, I think, more than any family in the world. So, and always we all stay at the same room and sleep with each other, both of all of us. So maybe that make us love each other more than before the siege.
We are very close to each other at the time of the siege.
And it sounds like still today.
Yes.
Yeah. It's continue until now.
Inshallah that it continues. Dr. Farida, an OBGYN, and ophthalmologist Dr. Abdulhalek were among a small group of Syrian doctors who continued to care for patients during the siege of Aleppo last year. Thank you both for being with us again.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
A quick look ahead now at a story we'll have for you. In a few minutes, we'll hear about a Syrian refugee in Sweden, an engineer by training who decided to take some time off to write a book. And the protagonist in it would help refugee kids deal with their trauma.
Usually in the world, people look at refugees with a bit of pity. But what I wanted to do, I wanted to create a hero character who went through a lot of hardships and she could maintain her happiness and she could believe in herself.
That story coming up a bit later here on The World. First, though, news headlines. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, we go a few rounds with a boxer who's inspiring young women in Jordan. Her gym is filled with inspirational messages like this one.
Be the kind of a woman when you wake up every day in the morning, the devil says, oh crap, she's up.
The story of She Fighter. That's ahead right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Billions of additional dollars for the Pentagon and border wall construction, big cuts for the State Department and the Environmental Protection Agency, among others. That, in a nutshell, is President Trump's budget proposal unveiled today. Lots to talk about, but right now we're going to take just one slice of it, how the proposed budget affects climate change programs. The president wants to eliminate funding for efforts to reduce power plant emissions. He also wants to zero out funding for UN climate programs. Andrew Light is a former climate negotiator with the State Department. I asked him what impact these cuts might have on the UN climate change agreement signed in Paris in 2015.
Well, we'll see. I mean, on the one hand, I think that we've already had some signals from China and the EU saying that they're going to stick in, they're going to double down, they're going to keep at the table. But we also know that there are many other countries out there where they were quite divided. There are folks still in those countries who think that they went too far out on a limb in joining the Paris Climate Agreement. And so these kinds of signals could reopen the debates in those countries about whether or not they're still committed to this process.
Now, Trump also wants to eliminate funding for climate change research. And this is at a time we should note that the head of the EPA, Scott Pruitt, says the science on man-made climate change is not clear and we need more review and analysis, which kind of implies research is in order. So somewhat contradictory signals. But let's talk about the international impact here. How important is U.S. climate change research to scientists all over the world trying to understand what's happening to this planet?
It's critically important. I mean, the United States is one of the biggest producers of the good hard science, the monitoring that's being done on climate change. So the threats to all these programs, from the technical work that we do with other researchers around the world to the actual operation of satellites where we're getting a lot of data, when that goes away, we're really undermining the global effort to respond to this problem.
So another climate-related program that the budget eliminates is something called the Global Climate Change Initiative. Tell us what that program does and what you think the impact of cutting it is going to be.
Well, the Global Climate Change Initiative was an umbrella initiative that brought together and clusters various climate change programs in the State Department and USAID and elevated those in the budget process. This represents dozens and dozens and dozens of bilateral programs that I worked on. So to give you an example, one of the things that I led was the State Department's work with India on climate change. Mm. And so using Global Climate Change Initiative money, I was able to create programs helping India with resilience, helping India with air quality initiatives, helping to create a better entrepreneurial environment in India with respect to clean energy innovation. So all that would fall under the Global Climate Change Initiative. This is a signal that all of it goes away. And that is bad. It's not just the specific amount of money we were putting into those programs, but the extent to which that signaled that the U.S. was there to help India, to help many other countries around the world to develop in a more sustainable way and also to become more resilient to climate change. So this completely undercuts our influence.
So where is the leadership on climate change going to come from if it's not coming from the U.S.? Like, is this a mouse that roared moment where a small country might take a leadership role?
Chinese have already been quite clear that they're prepared to step into this leadership role. They signaled that the very day of the U.S. election. We've also said that the EU is willing to step in there. There's also been historically a lot of leadership from some of the more vulnerable countries, the Pacific Island states, Africa, and others. So we could see the emergence of some leadership there as well. But make no mistake, there is going to be a devastating impact here if the U.S. completely backs away.
So Defense Secretary Mattis says that climate change is a threat to the Pentagon and U.S. interests. What effect could this budget have on national security?
Well, it undercuts our security because it basically eliminates the support we were giving to other countries, especially in unsecure parts of the world, to respond to climate change, especially on the resilience side of the issue. We know that climate change is what the Defense Department calls a catalyst for conflict. It makes places that are insecure less secure. It can accelerate conflicts. We've seen that in Syria. We've seen that in different parts around the world. And we've got very good scientific evidence that have tracked this and modeled this. So when we're backing away from this, it means that we're actually causing these places to be less secure because we're not supporting them anymore. And number two, it's decreasing our influence in these parts of the world. And that makes us less secure because we are basically abandoning our support for these places that are really on the front lines of the change.
So let's just imagine a hypothetical where Trump gets his way only to be succeeded in 4 years by someone in the White House who is more concerned about the climate and will pick up the baton where Obama left off. Will it be that easy after Trump? And do we even have that kind of time?
Well, here's what we know. We know that the longer we delay, the more expensive it becomes to deal with this problem and the increased risk to people around the world from climate-related disasters, from sea level rise, from all the stuff that's ongoing now. We can step back in there, but look at what we're doing. We're basically sending a signal to the rest of the world that U.S. commitments, that U.S. influence is not reliable, that it just takes an election to turn on a dime on that. So that's going to really make it much more difficult for the next American president who cares about this issue to jump back in the game because the well has already been soured.
Andrew Light was a climate negotiator in the Obama administration. He's now with the World Resources Institute in Washington, and he's a professor at George Mason University. Andrew, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Unlike the stalled travel ban, President Trump's crackdown on immigrants who are in the U.S. illegally is ramping up, and that could mean we'll see more people in detention centers. For some companies, more detained immigrants means more business. Washington Post reporter Michael Miller profiled one company working within the immigration system. It's called Libre by Nexus, and it's grown from a small operation to a booming business. What does Libre by Nexus actually do, and what's with the name?
So Libre in Spanish means free, and Libre by Nexus says that that's essentially what it offers its clients. So what happens when someone is an undocumented immigrant and they're detained, put into an ICE detention center? Sometimes they are offered a bond. It could be $5,000, $10,000, $20,000. But it's very difficult for them often to pay that amount. These are people who have come here with very little. So they are increasingly turning to this company, Libre by Nexus, which offers to help them post their bond and get out of detention. But in return, they have the immigrants wear these GPS ankle bracelets and pay monthly fees for months, sometimes years, until their immigration cases are decided.
And I gather you also found out that people signing up with Libre by Nexus don't always understand those details.
Most, if not all, of the immigrants that I spoke to said, They did not understand the contracts, which were given to them in English, a language that they don't speak for the most part. Some of them told me that when they got out of the ICE detention centers, they immediately had these ankle bracelets put around their ankles. Some of them didn't even know they would have to wear it. Those who asked questions or hesitated in signing the documents, some of them said that they were told, well, sign on the dotted line or we'll take you back to jail.
Did you speak with any detainees who were out on bond and wearing this ankle bracelet? And how did they feel about all this?
So, yeah, I spoke to a lot of them, and they said, in a way, they were grateful for getting out because this company did what other companies wouldn't do, which was get them out without requiring all this collateral. But at the same time, you know, the devil is in the details, and, you know, many of them were just frustrated, and some of them have gone as far as filing suit against the company, accusing it of fraud.
So one of the clients of Libre by Nexus is a man named Nefi Flores. Tell us what his situation was.
So Nefi Flores is a 26-year-old Salvadoran. He came to the United States in the summer of 2014. He says he was fleeing gang violence back in El Salvador. He was also trying to be reunited with his wife in Los Angeles. And so he essentially walked across the border in Texas and turned himself into Border Patrol, later claimed asylum. Problem was that he had spent all of his money trying to get to the United States. And he was unable to pay this $7,500 bond. So eventually, Nefi, sitting in this detention center in Tacoma, Washington, he heard of this company, Libre by Nexus. Mm. So his wife paid the company about 20% of his bond, $2,000, much less than the $7,500 bond. And he got out of detention. But he says that he didn't realize till the moment he got out and the company put this GPS bracelet monitor around his ankle that he was going to have to wear this clunky device. He also didn't realize, he says, until months later that payments of $420 a month wasn't going towards his bond, but rather was a rental fee that he would have to keep paying for years till his immigration case was decided.
And now Nefi Flores is one of the immigrants suing Libre by Nexus, correct?
Yeah, he filed a lawsuit accusing the company of fraud last May, and now the company has countersued him, alleging that he broke his contract.
Is Libre by Nexus taking advantage of the broken immigration system in the U.S.?
You know, the CEO, Michael Donovan, doesn't hide the fact that he expects business to double by year's end. I mean, business for Libre by Nexus is booming. He says that he wishes these people weren't detained and that they didn't have to use the company's services. But he says that they are essentially these immigrants' last hope for getting out of detention. But it's a controversial business practice. And a lot of immigration attorneys and advocates say that the company is basically preying on these vulnerable people instead of helping them.
What's the update on Nefi Flores? How's he doing?
The last I heard from Nefi was that he really just wants to get this ankle bracelet off. I mean, he's worn it for 3 years now. His neighbors see it and they think that he's committed some crime. He says that he's had, you know, bus drivers see it and call the authorities thinking that he's escaped from a detention center or a prison. And, you know, he says that he's just exhausted and wants this whole ordeal to end.
Washington Post reporter Michael Miller, thanks very much for the interview and for the story.
Thanks for having me.
This next story is part of a BBC series called School Report. It's about a book called Sarah's Story that's helping refugee children in Sweden deal with their trauma. The author is Imad El Abdallah, a former engineer from Syria who sought asylum in Sweden. He wrote the book with help from psychology professors at Stockholm University and the University of Vienna. Maddie Savage went to meet El Abdallah at a reading he was giving at a school in Stockholm.
The waves started to shake the boat from all sides until the boat flipped and everybody fell in the water. Sarah was so afraid and she was screaming. And then the sea talked to her and said, "Calm down, my dear. There's a boat coming close to us. The boat will pick you up. You'll be fine."
Imad El Abdallah, thank you so much for sharing an extract from your book. Tell us about this brand new refugee hero, the first in the world, really, in this book, which is aimed at 6 to 13-year-olds.
Usually in the world, people look at refugees with a bit of pity. But what I wanted to do, I wanted to create a hero character who went through a lot of hardships and she could maintain her happiness and she could believe in herself. I put my career aside and I dedicated 2 years of my life for this job.
I was researching and I was volunteering with Red Cross. I put all my money in it. I lived in very tight conditions until I make this dream come to life. We've been testing it on refugees and non-refugees, and the results are just amazing.
My name is Isaac, and I'm 10 years old, and I come from Sweden. Sarah's story is about a girl named Sarah who lives in her home country and has this, like, superpower that she can talk with nature, and nature tells her to always follow her dream. She has had a lot harder things to go through, while I just went to school, never had, like, any difficulties.
My name is Elmar. The main message was, like, to never give up, even though, like, doesn't matter what's in your way. Like, Sarah, she was still able to become a doctor, and like a heart doctor, and have a good life.
Jag heter Lana. Jag kommer från Syrien.
My name is Lana. I come from Syria. My story is almost the same as Sarah's. It's a good book, and other people should read it, so we can be friends.
Emma, clearly you can see from the kids today that they've enjoyed listening to the story and they've learned from it, but what about the long-term impact? You say this is also a therapy tool for displaced children, but how much can a book really help?
We cannot send a therapist to every child, so this is the problem. And what I wanted to do a therapy tool that can be easily sent to many places around the world. I've been researching a lot and included all the therapy tools that can appeal to children and heal them from post-traumatic stress disorder. And I've written it in a way that will change the perspective, how people look at each other. So integration process will be worked on from day one.
When it comes to integration, though, there are already big tensions here in Sweden. There's growing support for the Nationalist Party. There's a lot of concern about integration. So some people might argue it's a bit late.
It's never too late, actually, especially on the children, because they are the future adults. They will be the ones who would run the world in the future.
How has your own integration been here in Sweden? What kind of reception have you got?
I faced some prejudice here in Sweden, but I managed to get into the society in a very it wasn't an easy way, but it was in a short time. What made me do that is that my perspective about seeing the society, I tried to see the positive points in the society and to connect to people through things I loved. And this is what I teach to the kids. When you want to connect or communicate to any society you're being planted in, follow what you love and people will follow you. When you be the best of yourself, when you trust yourself, no one can stop you. You can go anywhere.
Syrian author Imad El Abdallah ending that report by the BBC's Maddie Savage. Just ahead, Jordanian girls floating like butterflies, stinging like bees. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Having the right mentor or role model can make a huge difference in a young person's life, but not everyone is lucky enough to have one. Some young women in Amman, Jordan are in luck, though. They have a new role model to look up to, and she's a fighter, really. The World's Shirin Jafari explains.
It's 5:30 in the afternoon in Amman, and the gloves are on.
Go, 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 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, jab, cross, jab, cross,
jab. It's time to practice those punches, jabs, and kicks. This is a female-only gym in Amman called She Fighter. It's on the second floor of an apartment complex. You have to press a buzzer to be let in. A group of teenage girls kick and punch the bags, mercilessly. The very human-like dummy gets the most severe blows. There are inspirational quotes on the walls. One of them reads, "Be the kind of a woman when you wake up every day in the morning, the devil says, 'Oh crap, she's up.'" It's from an Irish writer. 21-year-old Batul Jacob is the instructor this afternoon.
Boxing has changed my life, not just like physical-wise, but psychological-wise. Here in Jordan, most of the girls wait for someone to help them, whether it's her father or it's her brother. She always waits for someone to take an action. But here at She Fighter, we are trying to change this.
Okay, guys, let's do the next set.
She Fighter is the brainchild of Dina Khalifa, She has short hair and a boxer's body.
So I have to confess something. I'm a troublemaker.
That's her. And no, she's not a troublemaker. This is what her dad used to call her when she was a kid.
I really don't know why. Maybe because I always start a fight? Or maybe because I used to fight with boys a lot when I was a kid?
That, by the way, is from a TED Talk she gave recently. These days, though, Lina, the troublemaker, is running Jordan's first self-defense studio for women.
I started training taekwondo when I was 5 years old. I was really good. I started winning championships as I grew up, and I got about 20 gold medals, 3 of them international.
Khalifa went on to study French literature in university, and one day, as she was heading to class, she noticed something was wrong with her friend, Sarah. She had bruises all over her face.
She was being attacked by her brother and father. So when I tried to help her, she said, you know, we can't do anything. And it just pisses me off, the idea of women being hurt and they can't do anything.
At that time, Khalifa's taekwondo ambitions were on hold because of a nasty knee injury. So she thought, instead of training for medals, why not teach girls like Sarah how to stand up for themselves?
So I started training women self-defense at the basement of my parents' house.
And in that basement, Khalifa started teaching young girls a mix of taekwondo, boxing, and self-defense. She Fighter was born.
It was a challenge at the beginning. Not everybody was interested in the whole system. It took me about 1 year until I decided to leave the basement and start partnering with different gyms in Jordan.
A couple of years of partnership, and Khalifa finally managed to open up her own studio.
You have so many challenges. First, you're a woman. Second of all, you're a woman in business. Third of all, you're starting something that is really new to the whole society.
But slowly, people started to notice Khalifa and her work. The girls loved it. For some, the studio became a second home. And She Fighter grew by the day, to the point where it went from the basement of her parents' house to...
Welcome to the White House. We have more than 20 countries represented.
That was 2 years ago. But Khalifa had no idea she was going to meet the president.
Suddenly they're like, everybody sit down, the president will come.
And we want to empower leaders of social change, like Lina Khalifa of Jordan. Where's Lina? There she is.
It was a great push for me to know that I am being appreciated somewhere in the world by President Barack Obama. I can't stop, even though I have so many challenges here.
President Obama's praise for Khalifa followed her home. As we talk, one of her students runs over to show her something. It's an economics textbook, and Khalifa's name is in there. She's on a list of successful Jordanian entrepreneurs, the only woman.
Now the students can learn about people who are actually making a change in the society. They don't have to learn about somebody outside the country. Some of them, they want to be like me. Somebody wants to just develop their own skills. So I'm happy that I'm actually influencing them in a positive way.
Khalifa wants to go beyond this studio in Amman. She has set up classes for Syrian refugees. She's also expanding She Fighter to Saudi Arabia and possibly Kuwait.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Okay,
tonight's session is over. The girls collapse on the floor, their faces are all red, and they're dripping with sweat. A quote on the wall behind them reads, "It took me a long time to develop a voice. But now that I have one, I'm not going to be silent." Madeleine Albright. For The World, Shirin Jafari, Amman, Jordan.
Final heads up, Contraband is on tomorrow night in Austin at South by Southwest. That's spelled Contra, B-A-N-N-E-D, by the way. It's a showcase that The World is a part of. We've told you about some of the music on the bill, a little bit of everything representing some of the sounds from the countries that have been targeted by Trump's travel ban. Iraqi blues, Somali hip-hop, Libyan and Sudanese rap, and right now, a little dose for you of Iranian prog rock. If that's not your thing, think of Mohsen Namju as an ethereal performer singing in Farsi.
This Mohsen Namju track actually landed him in some controversy in Iran. It's called Taranj, and in it, Namju quotes verses from legendary Persian poets like Rumi and Hafez, as well as verses from the Quran. And he toys around with them. He plays on the words, which in the Islamic Republic is seen as disrespectful. Namju says it's not insulting. He embraces the poets and the Quran, but he also says it's his right to bring new meaning to their words. If you're in Austin, you can hear what he means tomorrow night. More information on our Facebook page. Just search for The World if you haven't liked us already. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for being with us.
سر خبر نداری، گفتم بر آستانه دارم سر نداری، گفتم دل رو باری ما را چون نبیری، گفتم چون هر
PRI, Public Radio International.